Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and I'm excited to be joined by my friend, Greg Katz, today. He is an American businessman, an environmentalist, a thought leader in the green economy sector. He's also the founder and the CEO of the Smart Surfaces Coalition, so we're going to be talking about his career and his current works today. Hey, Greg, welcome to the podcast. It's great to see you, man.
And fantastic to see you again, Ted. I'm delighted to be on the show with you today.
Yeah, like we said, I think it's been about 5 years. We've had a pandemic in between the last time we got together in DC. Are you in DC right now?
I am. I'm in my home. I work from home usually Mondays and Fridays.
Mm-hmm. And what is happening? You know, since we got together, you've been at the helm of the Smart Surfaces Coalition. I know nothing about it. What's hot this week? What are you working on?
So this week we're finishing up the quantification of benefits for funding we're raising to extend our work in India. In the U.S., our current project is with 10 metro areas, Atlanta, Dallas, New Orleans, about 32 million people. To help them reshape their surfaces, typically cooling a city by about 5 degrees, mostly in low-income areas. We were lucky a couple of years ago, the MacArthur Foundation funded us to extend our work to India, starting with one city, Bhopal. So this week I'm really wrestling with and making sure we've got the numbers locked down on what are the CO2e reductions from citywide surface transformation with what we call smart surfaces, so porous, reflective, green plus trees and PV.
And so let's unpack it a little bit, Greg. You laid out a lot of stuff there. Congratulations on the funding for taking your works to India. But the mission, what's the mission of the Smart Surfaces Coalition is?
Well, it's a little complicated. There's been billions of dollars of grant funding and going into cities over the last 2.5 decades to do pilot programs on green roofs or a reflective road or white roofs. And so after the pilots end, it's sort of back to business as usual. And cities during that 25 years have gotten hotter, darker, more unequal, more prone to flooding, larger contributors to climate change. So it's not a good direction. The cities are not on a pathway to being either substantially smaller contributors to climate change or protecting them from extreme heat, particularly multi-day heat waves and extreme flooding. So part of the problem that explains that is that cities think about each of these solutions in a very fragmented way. And they think about, well, we're going to work on low-income roofs, which is great. But the way to solve this is to think about the entire city surface as one solution to solve for two things: sun and all the heat that brings, and then rain. So these two gifts from God, right? Sun and rain. Cities turn that into excess heat, heat deaths, and air pollution, smog, and they turn it into flooding, which means mold and asthma and allergy being a recurrent chronic condition particularly in low-income areas. So it's really only by putting all of the solutions on the table, creating a name, Smart Surfaces is the term I came up with, and helping cities think about all of their surfaces in an integrated way, and then building the tools to solve for that, overcoming all the legal, statutory, and other obstacles to thinking about surfaces in an integrated way, and then assembling the leading national organizations to deliver that. Only if you do those things can you get to shift cities to say, hey, the pathway we're on, which is relying on people to buy more air conditioning, which, by the way, when you have a lot of air conditioning running, it can heat up a city by 2, 3, 4 degrees because you're dumping heat outside, right? AC is just an inefficient heat pump. It's only by sort of transitioning to saying we are going to do citywide cooling that you get out of this kind of death heat spiral where you add more air conditioning, dumping more heat outside, which then preheats the air intake. And it means air conditions operate even more, which means, you know, you look at Chicago, right? the heat wave there 15 years ago killed something like 750 people, almost all of those top floor, low income, dark roof. You don't solve for that with air conditioning because those people can't afford air conditioning or the air conditioning fails. The way you solve for that is make those roofs reflective so the rooms don't get as hot, and to make the city reflective so the ambient temperature citywide drops.
Well, let's use that as an example. Is Chicago one of your 10 cities?
It's not.
Oh, it was, well, let's just focus on one of the, you mentioned Atlanta, for example. How do you engage with those cities? Are you basically creating a smart surfaces sort of master plan for each city? Or what is it that you do?
We will work with the city only if we have a letter of commitment, signed letter of commitment from the mayor of that city saying they'll, you know, share data, they share this commitments, they want to make policy changes, they're enthusiastic about changing the surfaces of their cities. Then what we do is we have a set of firms that we raise money for. One is WRI, does fantastic work on satellite mapping. We have another firm which is great on data overlays and trees, Trust for Public Land. We have another one that does heat modeling, best heat modeling. So we integrate this analysis and then do a lot of bench research and work with the cities, work with groups like NOAA. So we end up with the most sophisticated and complete real-time mapping of city surfaces, and then an actual living digital rendition of that city that in real time you can play with. So to take an example, Baltimore, we built a cost-benefit analytic engine using this highly detailed satellite data and heat modeling. And then, so the city could run hundreds of scenarios. What if we had a bunch of trees over here? What if we changed the surface color of parking lots? What if we put in a cool roads requirement? What if, how can we address, you know, what happens to flooding and runoff if we change the porosity of surfaces? And from that, we supported them in adopting a set of measures, about a dozen measures, just to cool a city by about 4.3 degrees Fahrenheit. And then cities tend to either be strong mayor, in which case it's sort of done through an executive order or down through the agencies, or it's a strong city council. Baltimore is a strong city council. We've been supporting them in adopting a series of bills, the most recent of which is requiring that all low slope roofs, meaning commercial roofs, have to roughly quadruple their reflectivity. So that sun, instead of being absorbed by the building, re-radiating, heating up the community around it, is bounced up in the sky, literally exits the atmosphere. It's called global cooling forcing. So it actually bounces heat back out into space. And that heat then is not available at the city. So it doesn't heat up the buildings, doesn't heat up the neighborhoods, doesn't heat up the city.
And what about roadways? I remember years ago doing a helicopter flyover of Los Angeles for a transportation video we were doing. And I think the statistic was like 70% of Los Angeles is paved, you know, with parking lots and roads. And that's got to be a big part of the equation, right?
Huge. Yeah, I think in that 70%, you would include roofs. But roads are a problem. Roads are, you know, departments of transportation do the same surface that they've always done, which is, you know, very dark tarmac. So it's using basically oil products as a binder, and it absorbs over 90% of the sunlight. So if you walk around a new paved road or parking lot with a handheld heat device to measure heat, you'll get 165 degree readings. Eggs start to fry at 158. So there's an initiative called the Cool Roadways Partnership that we coordinate and manage. It's about 30 cities sharing data and findings on resurfacing roads and now parking lots. And typically they're finding that you can triple the reflectivity or the albedo. You end up with something that looks a lot like the surfacing on a tennis court. And LA, for example, has been a leader on this. They're finding that the cooling in adjacent residential areas is something like 2 or 3 degrees. So that's material. Mm-hmm. But if you only do roads, you're only getting at a piece of the problem. If you're only doing parking lots, you're getting at a piece of the problem. But if you're doing both steep slope and low slope roofs and parking lots and rows and trees, and then you're increasing pervious surfaces, now you've got, and trees, you're providing shading to buildings, particularly on the south and west side. Now you have a solution set that can make the city dramatically cooler. So the cities we work with, we can help them get on a pathway to cool 10 times faster than they're being heated by global warming.
That's fantastic. But now, Greg, I hate to be the downer, but there is a marginal cost, I presume, for these better pavements and these better roof coatings, and obviously the cost of planting trees and all the other mitigation measures. And then the benefit is really societal. Are we sort of back to this whole, you know, this lack of direct incentive? And is that a big part of the challenge?
It's a great question. We know the cost down to the cent per square foot. We know the installation cost. We know the maintenance cost. We know the repair cost. But we've all walked through neighborhoods on vacations or visiting towns, cities, and loved them. Love the neighborhoods. And why do we love them? Well, it's often because they have shade, and often they're lighter in color, and they've got a lot of green materials in them. Windows are open. It feels like the outside is really comfortable. You have a combination of shade and light, which biophilia reminds us is kind of where humans grew up, as in savannas, with a combination of light and shade. And so the challenge is, how do you quantify the benefits completely enough and rigorously enough that the city can then use that to make a more informed decision? So we've hired a small team at the Chan School of Public Health at Harvard to quantify additional health-related benefits from these kinds of interventions. And what we're able to do is, so our partners on my steering committee, the head of the American Lung Association, head of the American Public Health Association, Georges Benjamin, who's a medical doctor. So we can bring to bear the leading medical organizations to quantify health benefits, things that actually accrue to the city, like 311 calls, 911 calls, non-reimbursed hospital visits when it's really hot, it's very expensive. The cost to workers in terms of sick days, downtime. These start to add up as actual costs to the city. It's interesting, with Baltimore, we found a 10-to-1 benefit cost ratio.
Really?
But when you then layer on top of it, what does it do to tourism? The answer is really very interesting, Ted. The summer tourism industry is a big deal in Baltimore. It's like 7 or 8% of the employment. And summer tourists are going elsewhere because it's too hot. So all these mom and pop shops that make up the Tourism Bureau for Baltimore, you know, this is hotels, motels, restaurants, tourism services. They're kind of freaking out because they're losing summer tourists. And that's their big summer season, right?
Yep.
So the idea of getting on a pathway where the city cools itself by 5 degrees Fahrenheit is something that makes them very happy, because now they're retaining summer tourism. They can brand themselves as a cool city that's on a trajectory to becoming cooler as the alternative tourist destinations get hotter, right?
So you can really help. You can really help then a city justify
absolutely
these investments, right? Because you quantified the cost of all these measures. You've done the modeling to figure out what, you know, which measures go where, and then you've been able to quantify and qualify a lot of the benefits.
Yeah, that's right. And some of it's unexpected. So there's a three-part series we did in Risk and Insurance, which is a leading global publication on this issue, documenting how adoption of smart surfaces protects and enhances city credit rating. When cities have a large CapEx project, like they want to build out a new wastewater treatment facility, they might go out to the municipal bond market, raise $250 million. The cost of capital for them in those muni bond markets matter a lot. And so if they can say to Standard & Poor and Moody's, the credit rating agencies, hey, we're on a pathway here to reduce our city's risk, vulnerability around climate and extreme heat, that protects their city credit rating. It protects their ability to raise capital inexpensively on municipal bond markets. So a CFO in a city might not care very much about quality of life in a neighborhood, might not care about hospital visits, but he or she might care a lot about a city credit raising. So there's a lot of different pieces to this. We help bring those pieces together with, you know, leading groups, American Institute of Architects, and allow a city to make an fully informed decision and to control the direction of that city's future in a world in which extreme heat is increasingly common in extreme rain events. So to take Baltimore again as an example, something like more than half of low-income homes have experienced flooding. That means mold, means asthma, it means allergy, means more sick days, means kids not in school. So it really affects the workforce and educational quality in Baltimore. Hard to quantify, but once you quantify it, the numbers are very large. And so for a mayor, the mayors we work with are super excited because this puts their city on a completely different trajectory. We're going into a climate change world. We're out ahead of it. Our flooding risks are going down. Our temperatures are going down. The differential in heat between low income and wealthy neighborhoods is going down. And we're becoming a place where people can be outdoors during the summer and where summer tourism is protected, all those jobs of people in, you know, cafes or people going in between museums or being down on the waterfront. So it's an exciting, it's a wonderful group to work with because it's a very powerful, optimistic message is how do you control your future in a context of climate change and protect the quality of life in a way that you can measure and hand down to future generations.
We're really getting to this point of monetizing both the impacts of climate change and then the benefits of mitigating climate change like you're talking about. How does the Bhopal project, is it different? Is it materially different from what you're doing in Atlanta and the other U.S. cities?
It's an interesting question. In some ways it is. In some ways it's identical. So it's another, you know, city that has several million people where wealthy people tend to have air conditioning and poor don't, where low-income neighborhoods are hotter and more heat deaths, more prone to flooding. India has about a 12% air conditioning penetration. They have about 80 million window air conditioning units. Business as usual projections are it'll get to about 1.1 billion by 2050. And that's a problem because those air conditioners work by dumping heat outside. So you see multi-day heat waves where 3-4 degrees of temperature pickup Fahrenheit is from air conditioning. And even if you get to 1.1 billion air conditioners in India by 2050, half of all Indians still don't have air conditioning. So now you've got hotter cities exacerbated by more heat from air conditioning with multi-day heat waves, bigger urban populations, more cars and appliances spewing heat, and huge vulnerable populations who don't have access to cooling, you know, which is really the beginning of the Ministry of the Future. That book is a multi-day heat event that kills millions of people. And so how do you avoid that? The answer cannot be air conditioners, more air conditioners for wealthy people, because that hurts everyone else. It's got to be citywide cooling, and that's really what we're providing.
God, that's really fantastic, Greg. What a great thing to be working on. It's got to be very gratifying.
Well, it's fun. We're starting to get some real traction, and we're starting to see that young people, it gives them a sense of hope. And because it's pretty jobs intensive doing things like planting trees, there's a sense that, hey, I can make my, you know, I can have a growing career, a successful career doing this while protecting my neighborhoods, while remaining true to my beliefs.
Yep. Now, we don't have a lot of time to talk about your career, but I do want to, and it ain't over by a long shot here. You're a young pup by my standards. but I did want to, it's sort of fun to query people a little bit. How was it that you were born in Paris, Greg? What's the Parisian connection that in you?
Well, my dad had come over as an immigrant and then joined the U.S. Army, fought in the Second World War, went back on the GI Bill of Rights, was studying in Paris, which I think mostly involved sitting at cafes. And met my mother, who had come from America and was studying sculpture. So they met there, married, had some kids, and then moved back to the U.S. when I was young.
And I think then you grew up in Connecticut, or wasn't Connecticut?
I did,
your hometown. Yep. And then I met you at Rocky Mountain Institute. I know I'm fast forwarding, but I met you at Rocky Mountain Institute. By that time, you had been at UNC Chapel Hill, where you met our good friend Russell Sturm. And I think you had either finished your Princeton program where you were in the midst of that. Is that right? When you were at RMI?
Yeah, I was at, did a joint degree, they let me create it between the a graduate program at Princeton and then an MBA at Stanford. And so before I took my sort of big sort of post MBA job, had known Amory Lovins. I'd spoken at a conference with him some years before and went and spent the summer working at Rocky Mountain Institute, which was just a fantastic thing to do.
It sure was. And then I know I'm going quickly here, but our good friend Art Rosenfeld, Dr. Art Rosenfeld, who was obviously at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and then at the California Energy Commission, and then he ended up going to the DOE, and he called you up and said, come on over, I guess. So you were at the Department of Energy as the director of the finance of efficiency and renewables. Is that right?
Yeah, I actually got to DOE before him. I had worked on the campaign and I wanted to work at DOE because DOE was doing the funding for things like solar and wind and batteries and green buildings. So I had the opportunity to be in the first design charrettes for LEED, the National Green Building Standard, and had an opportunity to really work very closely with Art, who I really miss. He's such an extraordinary human being.
And that was during the Clinton administration.
Exactly, the Clinton Gore years.
And then another project that I just sort of thought, boy, Greg is really doing hard work, but was creating that international protocol for measurement and verification of performance and just being able to, maybe you can just talk about the need for that protocol in order to be able to unlock financing for those measures, right?
It's like the world's most boring subject, but I'll do my best, Dad.
Well, just keep it short. Well, boring, but you dug in and you were all over it for a number of years.
Well, I was. The energy efficiency industry was struggling because how people did energy efficiency differed. So big companies like Schneider, Johnson Controls, Siemens had their own methodology for how they do efficiency, how they measure and verify. And because there was no standard, you couldn't pool energy efficiency projects, you couldn't get off balance sheet financing. So the energy efficiency industry was really stuck. Should be able to access low cost financing, couldn't, should be able to use modern mechanisms for financing and couldn't. And I had worked for some years after Stanford in the corporate world. And so I came back, and the reason this job was so interesting, me being director of financing for efficiency and renewables, it allowed me to work with Wall Street firms to bring that insight and kind of discipline to bear in the energy efficiency and other markets that frankly were pretty inefficient. Yeah. And so Art and I had the opportunity to chair it, were able to persuade dozens of leading organizational national associations to drop their particular design and measurement verification for efficiency and sign on to and co-build a single consensus standard called the International Measurement and Verification Protocol. And that is now a requirement for all federal buildings. It's the standard used by all the multilateral development banks like the World Bank. It's really become the global standard. And because you have standards in designing, measure, and verification, you can take a project done by Johnson Controls or one done by a hospital and another by a building chain or another done at the state level, and they all look the same. They're all structured the same. They're all measured the same. You can pool those into a single asset pool of, let's say, $500 million and sell it off much more cheaply and efficiently. So it created access to financial markets that brought down the cost of energy efficiency and in turn allowed an acceleration in the growth of that energy efficiency industry.
A huge, huge accomplishment, Greg, and not boring. When you really start to look at the implications, you spent years with Good Energies, which is you've been really involved with helping investment firms get into the clean energy space. I think you're still doing that. You have your own company, Capital E, where you're probably still providing advisory services. There was a project I wanted to ask you about. The whole Blue Planet project. And this sort of, it speaks to some of the technologies that you've helped to foster and to finance. Can you just describe that project in brief?
Sure. So I was really lucky. I got brought into Good Energies, which was probably the first large private equity firm in the space, as a managing director about 20 years ago. And we did about $350 million in investment in companies in decarbonization and clean energy in the US and Europe and Asia. Blue Planet, what you're talking about, is a California-based company that's gone through three rounds of venture capital funding. I was on the board of it for many years. And it takes flue stack gas and it turns it into aggregate. And this is really important because aggregate is about 75% by volume of concrete. Concrete is, which includes cement, is on the order of 7 or 8% of the world's CO2. And so what's exciting about Blue Planet and several dozen other decarbonization companies in the concrete space is they allow you to cut your CO2 and then over time actually have concrete be a way to sequester carbon. So we're the San Francisco airport is doing $11 billion upgrades, hired my little firm, Smart Surface Coalition, to do a heat mapping of the airport to cool the airport, but also to help them figure out how to decarbonize. And you can imagine airports pour a lot of concrete. And so the ability for them to say, hey, we're going to cut the carbon intensity of concrete and over time have that concrete store CO2, it's just a very powerful way to participate in, you know, in slowing climate change. That's Let me really make one other comment, yeah, if I may, on this. Like the IPMVP, having a single standard metric to quantify and then be able to compare the CO2 intensity of concrete is essential. And so I've been involved with others in creating the first such international standard for concrete CO2 intensity. It's called Carbon Star. It's based on Energy Star. It's now being released as a U.S. and Canadian national standard. It's an ANSI standard. Very, very simple. It's being used in environmental product declarations and on a standalone basis by, you know, groups like the San Francisco Airport that say, hey, we want to impact carbon, not just in terms of energy consumption, but in terms of embodied carbon. And concrete is just too big to leave off the table. So we want a single, rigorous, industry-supported way to quantify, compare, and specify carbon intensity of concrete. And Carbon Star provides that for the first time.
That is great. So, Greg, final question. You've done an awful lot. I prepped for this discussion by looking up your bio and all, and I don't know how you've accomplished all this. You've won the President's Award from the U.S. Green Building Council. You've won the Alliance to Save Energy's Lifetime Achievement Award. And as I said earlier, you ain't slowing down. So how are you doing this, Greg? Are you taking a lot of vitamins? Do you go to the gym and work out every day? How do you maintain this productivity level and the balance in your life that keeps you the mellow dude that I know?
Well, that's such a great question. I don't even want to answer it. I try and meditate every morning. I'm an innately lazy person, Ted. So what I try to do is figure out who's doing something really, really well, and then how do I support that person? So 80% of the money that, you know, I raise goes to partners, and it goes to partners because, you know, when we raise money for an American Public Health Association, people care what the American Public Health Association says about health. They don't care at all what I say or my NGO, the Smart Surface Coalition, says. So we're really, in trying to build the infrastructure to support a transition, our job is to do as little as possible. We do those things that are essential and no one else is doing. Otherwise, we raise the money for organizations that do this vastly better, their piece of it, whether it's satellite monitoring, whether it's providing funding to African-American churches in the cities we work in, whether it's detailed health research that we're funding at Harvard, looking for the first time at the relationship between heat and health in the country's two largest data sets, Medicare and Medicaid. So we're fortunate in being able to find partners that want to do this work, fortunate to be able to raise money for them, and fortunate to be able to support them and integrate this work and bring it to bear at the level of a city making decisions to change those surfaces in those cities.
That's great stuff. Hey, let's leave it there. We'll have another conversation in another year or two, but this has been fantastic. Greg, thanks so much for what you're doing and have done. And thanks for being on the podcast today.
Ted, it's a great pleasure. I love seeing you again. Love talking with you. Thank you for what you do.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.